Father in the heavens, you know what I want to achieve in this presentation, but that doesn't matter. What really matters, Father, is what your objectives are. What do you want to achieve, Father? What do you want to accomplish in this among the saints? Please, Father, cause every word of your approval to find fertile soil and take root and bear good fruit among your children. And everything that I've said amiss coming up here, cause that to fall to the ground. I also pray specially, Father, with my fellows here in the service, that you pour your loving kindness upon our beloved Elder Sam Graham up there at the Assembly in Michigan. We ask, Father, you issue a word from your throne that you rebuke and overthrow the infection in his foot from that cellulitis, and that you command healing and total relief by Yahshua's stripes. And in his name we pray always. Hallelujah. Amen. Well, it's funny. Brother Terrell didn't quite get the title right, and I didn't quite get the title right. I've been messing with this title for a while. Right now, friends, I'm calling it The Document Few Will Touch. I'm Brother Michael from Fulton, Missouri. May all the grace of Yahshua be yours. This document that I'm going to talk about is called The Constitutions of the Holy Apostles. And it has various names, but that usually has something to do with constitutions and apostles. Today is Sabbath, June 7th, 2025. And many of the slides, it's funny, I have about half the slides or less than I typically have with other presentations. Who knows, maybe we'll get done early. But so many versions of this have been published, and the texts are out there, the manuscripts are out there, and people will publish it, but you won't find very many people doing expository presentations on them. It's really funny when you step back and think about it. This is Sabbath, June 7th, 2025, and it's the day before Pentecost. At times, I'll be asking the control room to focus the camera on me or on the slides, but for the moment, I'm going to ask the control room if they could give us a shot of that lovely loaf of bread prepared for fellowship meal down there below the lectern. I hope somebody's capturing that. Now, one of our local brethren is a highly skilled baker, and he weaved that into a kind of like a sheaf of wheat. Now, if this was earlier in the year, like around Passover time, it might be a sheaf of barley, but this looks like a shape of a sheaf of wheat. After services, we're going to cut that thing up and we're going to enjoy it. But so I can guarantee you, if it was made by that beloved brother, it's going to be yummy. Let me quote some scriptures to set the pace. Again, on every slide, you're going to see a different book cover for the various people who published this thing in English. A couple of scriptures to set the pace, though. Jeremiah 6:16. Thus saith Yahweh, stand you in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein, and you shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. You know, there's always this desire to go to the past. And I know the past can be just as evil as the present. But somewhere in the past, we do find the answers, the ancient ways. And it's so obvious. Once you study the history of the New Covenant faith, it's so obvious. Oh, my lands. At large, people have gone running in the wrong direction, drifting far from the center of Yah's will. And some of that is due to the scribes. Jeremiah 8:8. How do you say we are wise and the law of Yahweh is with us? Lo, certainly in vain made he it. The pen of the scribes is in vain. There are people who document things wrongly. It's funny, whenever the subject of misinformation and the corruption that we see at play among the main news wires, you have to understand that being a scribe is kind of a corrupt business. It was actually Hillary Clinton who once said that we are in an information war in this age. Isn't that something to know that stake began with her, you know? So who has the red-hot information? You know, when you look at old manuscripts of stuff that was done in the past, it's going to be hard. Outside of biblical manuscripts, it's hard to find stuff that is well-preserved and accurate or reliable. And so you have to go into these documents like the one we're doing here. You have to go in there with your head screwed on right, and you have to have filters and traps and protections and constraints there. Because you have people writing stuff that's often done amiss. In this presentation, we will discuss the transition from the Messianic faith to early Christianity, and notice it has information gaps. Now, we do have freeze frame snapshots of the doctrinal decay. And it can happen to anything. You start out with a real high, pure set of doctrines, devotional framework, good teachings. And over time, they decay, they slide, and other stuff gets in there, and it gets all mingled up. Now, these documents, particularly the one I'm going to talk about here, they cannot be talked up and celebrated among Western Roman Christianity because of the content. There's content in there that makes us look good, and you don't want that stuff to get out there. But we don't like to talk about them, probably because they're hard to untangle. You're like, you've got to unravel the truth and the error. Excuse me. I would not take your time asking you to go with me and drill down through something like the Book of Mormon. Sweet and beautiful people. And some biblical plenty of biblical teachings get in there, but they blend it with a lot of strange stuff. I'm not going to put you through that. The material like this, though, has value because it's evidence of the decay that we have been reporting ever since we did any research on this. Start out with real high, pure doctrine, and it starts to decay. And if you can get a snapshot, a data set, during that decay, you're going to see an alarming blend of error and truth. It's kind of amazing that this one going on. Now, at issue for many of us is the lack of documentation from the apostles flowing into the earliest so-called church fathers. I hope you guys are keeping on the view graphs, please. Now, when you look in that era from the apostles over here, I'm going with your timeline, the apostles over here, then the so-called early church fathers over there, you got this gap. And you would expect to see a lot of information there. All right, guys, here's the truth. This is what I want you to pass on to the future. Here you go. Take it and run with it. But we see very little in there. Very little information. Let me give you like an example. When you go from the Moses era to Joshua through Judges and then into the book, the time of the kings and the prophets, you can see the continuity. There's a lively sense of handoff. Let's keep it going. You have periodic revivals. It's very well documented. And in this age, archaeology is uncovering a breathtaking array of verifications of the Bible story. We recently saw, we were going through the book of Judges a few months ago, and there was a striking online documentary from, I think, Joel Kramer, where an obscure story in the book of Judges is verified archaeologically with breathtaking precision. But it happens so often. It seems every month I look up and there's like a new finding, a new dig. But when you go from the apostles to the so-called early church fathers, there's this gap. Nobody's writing anything, with few exceptions. Now here, I'll give you some examples. There's a fellow named Polycarp who is recognized as a direct disciple of John the Apostle. And we see him fighting for Passover as opposed to Easter. But it isn't documented by him. It's documented a couple hundred years later by somebody else. I think at least two authors. Then there's the martyrdom of Polycarp. Now, again, disciple of John, revered, very holy man. That document, the martyrdom of Polycarp, it says that he was arrested on a Sabbath and then he was executed on a high Sabbath. How did that get in there? How did that slip through? these, you know, the anti-Sabbath crowd, they would be leery talking that up. It's only known among scholars or people like this who will try to drill down and get to the bottom of it. There's the first epistle of Clement. It might be the Clement mentioned in the New Testament. We're not sure. It could be. But it's simply a letter telling, I believe, the brethren at Corinth to reinstate some fallen elders. And the apostles weren't around when he wrote that. And if we saw that letter, we might disagree with him. Because, you know, there are points at which the elders are no longer above reproach if they do something really naughty. And it's hard on the saints to put up with that. But this is all we have. We have these scraps, the martyrdom of Polycarp, history about him in an era that's poorly documented. He's fighting for Passover as opposed to Easter. The first epistle of Clement. The rest of the stuff attributed to the, quote, apostolic fathers, the material is weak. And there's not much there you can sink your teeth into. Here's a chart I made. I didn't get this from anywhere else, but the dates came from another source. What I did is I took the dates of some of these old documents from the past, and I took an average of the range, and I plotted them out on a timeline. And I'm going to try to cast light on this. There's a gap there between the apostolic writings and the early Christian writings. Now, the gap is probably wider than it looks, because the dates of the early Christian writings are in dispute. But there's clearly a gap there where the handoff of the traditions and the doctrines, it's like an empty paper bag. I would think that would be jam-packed with information. Here's what the apostles told me. Here's how often I visited them. And that stuff is just missing. Yeah, I hate to invoke this, but it's hard to escape the impression that important documents have been destroyed. Can we just say it? I hate to say it, but, you know, and important information about what the apostles taught is not getting passed on to the early Christian writings. But what we do find in early writings, we do find glimpses of what we believe, having done a lot of research. Okay, this is a passage we often mention. I'm going to just throw it up there. This is from a historian named Jesse Lyman Hurlbut, his classic work, The Story of the Christian Church. Now, I'll tell you, we quote this a lot. I had to really work hard to find this. So those of you taking notes out there, here it is. You'll find a lot of this stuff on archive.org. Now, be careful. It's not archive.com or anything like that. Archive.org. There are similarly named web pages that are Trojan and virus traps, okay? I'm going to read this quote because it sets the pace. We name the last generation of the first century from 68 to 100 AD, quote, the age of the shadows, partly because the gloom of persecution was over the church, but more especially because of all periods in the history, it is the one about which we know the least. We have no longer the clear light of the book of Acts to guide us. And no author of that age has filled the blank in the history. We would like to read of the later work by such helpers of St. Paul as Timothy, Apollos, and Titus. But all these and St. Paul's other friends drop out of the record at his death. For 50 years after St. Paul's life, a curtain hangs over the church through which we strive vainly to look. And when at last it rises about 120 AD with the writings of the earliest church fathers, we find a church in many aspects very different from that in the days of St. Peter and St. Paul. Now, I've quoted him pretty closely here. There's no common titles to worry about, but I wouldn't call him St. Paul or Peter. According to the scriptures, we are all saints. You know, it really is good to see friends who have traveled to join us for the Pentecost weekend. I surely welcome you. Hallelujah, all of you. Now, that's supposed to be an image of Polycarp there. I captured this from Wikipedia. It's a snapshot of an existing mosaic of Polycarp by a fellow named Shako. It's at the citation's there at the bottom of the screen. Now, there's an episode around 100 AD, and even that date varies by plus or minus 20, 30 years. In this episode, Polycarp, a direct disciple of John, traveled to Rome to beg that they retain Passover observance rather than Easter. But the travel is not documented anywhere contemporaneously with Polycarp himself. The dating of the event has wide possibilities, and it is documented only by later authors, 100 years later, 200 years later, and more. I would love to know the juicy details of this encounter. Can you imagine the letters that went back and forth? Wouldn't they be a treasure chest for us? All gone. All we get is like shadows. So, given the transformation of the original devotional framework, whatever the apostles were doing and teaching, our expectation is that any documents from the early Christian era will have blends of the original teachings and foreign novelties. Remember, it starts out with pure doctrine, and then it decays. And while it's decaying, we have fellow saints who pull away from mainstream Christianity. They say, no, you guys are going in the wrong direction. And some of them are hunted through Europe like animals, just because they didn't plug into that mainstream thing. So when it comes to a document like the Constitutions of the Apostles, how can we bravely engage these documents? So I'm going to give you the framework I used, because we want to have some constraints. We want to protect ourselves. So here's a method, a framework for assessing the content of early writings. Well, number one, if the content is found in the Bible and the Roman Church later rejected it, get that. It's in the Bible, and it's in this document, and then Western Christianity rejected it. Bang, we got something. Those are the nuggets. Like, wow, they did that? But today nobody does it, except us. Right? Those are gems. Woo. If the content resembles Bible instructions but with obvious distortion, we will note it as such. Well, they came close, right? It was close. Some cases, it might have been in the same, geographic region, but they're definitely not in the ballpark. Some cases, they come very close. And finally, if the content is nowhere to be found in the Bible, we just blow it off. Every now and then, you're going to see them do something. It's nowhere in the Bible anywhere. And you wonder, where did they get that stuff? My belief is that you all don't want to be experts on this. And so I've decided to just focus on some things and give you evidence that there were saints in the past who were living with decay and compromises sneaking in here and there. So now I introduce the document few will touch, the Constitutions of the Apostles. Though it's considered among the writings of the Apostolic Fathers, no one knows who wrote it. It is a key document in understanding the development of Catholic tradition, and you'll see why in a moment. Here's a gross outline. It has 8 books in it. Book 1-6 is a rewording of the apostolic teachings called the Didascalia Apostolorum. Book 7 is essentially the Didache. Now it looks like Didache, doesn't it? That's the Didache. And Book 8 is a collection of instructions on, I'll say, quote, how to run your church. And in my eyes, it looks very Catholic in its tone. That's Book 8. There's times I read that, I go, man, that looks like Catholic stuff to me. But you have to be a Catholic to know that. Now let's talk about this Didache. We're going to go back upstream. Book 7 is essentially the Didache. Now Elder Allen talked about the Didache. It's a short document. And that's how I got into this whole thing. I'll tell you more in a moment. Book 1-6 is a rewording of the apostolic teachings called the Didascalia Apostolorum. And that's where the juicy stuff is. Now, I could have made this a presentation on the Didache, and then the Didascalia Apostolorum, and then I don't know if I'd waste my time on Book 8. But I don't think you guys want to be experts on this. My objective is to edify you with verification that some things that were important to us weren't observed in early Christianity. As you pivot from a messianic belief to Christianity, you're going to have in that transition some well-represented things that are from the Bible, but later rejected by the church. I'd just like you to look briefly. Look at the word didaskalia. If you could look at the screen, please. Control room, look at the word didaskalia. The first four letters are D-I-D-A. And then the didache, the first four letters are D-I-D-A. Both of those words mean teaching. Okay? Teachings of the apostles and then the teaching. Let's talk about the didache a little bit. That's what got me into this. I don't know exactly the sequence of events that got me to this place. But I discovered in my studies maybe two decades ago or more that there were instructions published in early Christianity about what days to fast. And I looked at that, and they said, don't do your weekly fast on Tuesday and Thursday. No, don't do it on Monday and Thursday, because that's when the Jews do it. Now, right off the bat, that's a turnoff. Don't do it because the Jews do it. And you'll find this in early Christian writings, this disdain for anything Jewish. The danger of that might be more evident as this unfolds. They said, no, rather you fast, you Christians fast on Wednesday and Friday. And I started to download multiple translations, and I noticed them. Some of them did not say Wednesday and Friday. They said Wednesday and Preparation Day. So wait a minute. Whoa. Some translations are saying Wednesday, Friday. Some are saying Wednesday and Preparation Day. Are you telling me Friday's Preparation Day? If you're going to call Friday Preparation Day, what's it a preparation for? The ball game? What? It's a preparation for Sabbath. Obvious. So I went and captured one of the Greek texts of the Didache. It was very hard to synchronize it. I mean, you know some Greek when you hang around the stuff long enough. And I zoomed in, and there it was. It's in the Greek word is preparation day. That was one of the days they urge people to fast. Now, the Didache doesn't mention Sabbath anywhere else, but it just calls Friday preparation day. And, there's a little more to this. Let me think a moment. Romans 14. You'll notice how some opponents of the Sabbath will use Romans 14 to overthrow the Sabbath. One guy celebrates this day. Another guy celebrates that day. Some guy eats this, another guy eats that. And it's obvious after you step back, it has nothing to do with Sabbath because the Sabbath is not in there. Romans 14 doesn't mention Sabbath at all. But yet anti-Sabbatarians will say, each guy celebrates his own day, you know. Well, that passage is about your preferred day of fasting. And isn't it ironic? Paul's saying, let everybody fast according to, you know, their own convictions. And yet this Didache is telling people, you fast on Wednesday and on preparation day. It's ironic that that thing, which is disobeying Paul, inadvertently gives us evidence that the Sabbath was up and running. That's what got me started in all this. This whole thing about ancient writings claiming to be from the apostles. And scholars have looked at the larger work, the constitutions, and they can see hands in there changing things and moving things around and redacting. It's all kind of funny, which makes it all the more interesting what juicy things might be in there preserving the original doctrine. So let me characterize this for you based on a scholarly reference. Probably originated, let me back up. This is from a book called Daily Liturgical Prayer, Origins and Theology by Gregory Wolfenden. And it's published after the turn of the century. He states, probably originating in Syria and originally composed in Greek, Bradshaw, another scholar, dates this work to about 375 to 380 CE. Books 1 to 6 are a reworking of the Didaskalia, while Book 7 is a version of the Didache. Book 8 elaborates the apostolic tradition, adding more liturgical material. Well, that statement about Book 8 is generous, adding more liturgical material. I ain't going to tell you what to read and not read, but I don't waste my time with book eight. But he in turn quotes this guy Bradshaw, Paul Bradshaw, book called The Search for the Origins of Christian Worship. He published it before the turn of the century and reissued it in 2002. So those who want to, you know, swim upstream and look at the references that have characterized this, that's a good start. I want to emphasize that book seven is essentially the Didache. And I'm going to show you how I got this thing. Because before I do any analysis, I want to equip people who want to do their own research. Now, if you want the PDF that I created, contact me. I'll get it to you, okay? I'm sorry, Lucas, you might get some emails making inquiry on this. I'm going to give you a webpage for those of you on the who only hear an audio outreach. I'm going to read it off. I'm going to ask those of you in the control room to zoom in on this or give the viewers access to this page. Here we go with the webpage, https://ccel.org/ccel/, then the name SCHAFF, that's spelled S-C-H-A-F-F, slash, ANF07/ANF07 .ix.html. Okay, that's the start page. This is an online resource. If you're going to capture it, you better do it quick. If you look in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see navigation arrows. There's about 50 pages. I downloaded all of them in PDF form. You know, you can print a PDF. I downloaded every one of them. And I got this jumbo collection of PDF pages. Then I imported them into a professional version of Adobe and concatenated them to one giant document. So I got the whole enchilada text searchable. It's 267 PDF pages. It's so hard to find one searchable version of this. But I found a quality one online, downloaded to PDF, and then put them all together in one big bundle. Okay, here we go. We're going to spend the rest of our time drilling down through the content and get examples of people doing things like us. In the Apostolic Constitutions, the Sabbath is mentioned 22 times. It is always in a positive light, except when it does the citation from Amos 5:12 and Isaiah 1:14. You know, that's the one where Yahweh's fed up with the hypocrisy, and he says, I hate your Sabbaths and your new moons and all that. It's the only time Sabbath is mentioned in a negative light. All the other times it's talked about is like, this is something you're going to do, this is something you got to do, you're going to keep Sabbath. Now, what I've done is I've taken my PDF and done like snippets and blasted them in there so you have an idea, a feel for what it looks like. But the part I'm quoting, I'll blitz with my own lettering down below. You shall observe the Sabbath on account of him who ceased from his work of creation, but ceased not from his work of providence. It is a rest for meditation of the law, not for idleness of hands. I failed to highlight the word law. Whoever these people were, they were expected to keep Sabbath and meditate on the law. There's another citation of the Sabbath. This is an interesting one. Sabbath is just an ordinary part of their lives. And this business of congregational government, where you settle disputes, iron things out, they use the word judicatures in this translation. And it says, let your judicatures be held on the second day of the week, that if any controversy arise about your sentence, having an interval till the Sabbath, you may be able to set the controversy right and to reduce those to peace who have the contests one with another against the master's day. Now, what is the master's day? Now, this is something we have to confront. There is nothing in the Bible telling us to worship on, quote, the master's day. Now, you have the Lord's day in the book of Revelation, but that's highly controversial. There are alternate manuscripts that don't say it exactly like that. There's reason to believe that John was in the Spirit on the Sabbath. Yahshua said he is master of the Sabbath. Now, those who are anti-Sabbath, they think Yahshua is sovereign over nothing, because Sabbath doesn't exist in their minds. But when it says Master's Day, I naturally think Sabbath. That's Yahshua's day. We have evidence, as you pivot from the Messianic faith to early Christianity, some of these Roman Christians were getting together on Sunday morning and just had some prayers, exchanged words of encouragement, and went on with their day. And we have evidence, as the corruptions crept in, this started to grow in importance. The earliest mention that we know for sure what they're talking about is like 120 AD. So this is way after the apostles' time. Anyway, there you're going to see, if you start getting into this, these documents, you'll find mention made of the Lord's Day. Sometimes in the same paragraph where it says, keep the Sabbath and make sure you get together in the morning on the Lord's Day. And historians will say it looks like they were keeping both days, according to these documents. Well, the Sabbath was an up-and-running reality. You know, let's see, do we have... Yeah, we have another one here. But being mentioned 22 times in a positive light as something you got to go do or as a reference point, there's no doubt that our fellow saints back then were keeping Sabbath. And they were keeping it seriously. You know, it occurred to me before I got up here that maybe there was too much emphasis in this material on stuff that we would delight in, stuff that we would say, yeah, you're doing the right thing. But I should tell you, the overall tone, except for Book 8, the overall tone of these documents is a lifestyle characterized by a whole lot of fasting. They call for a whole lot of fasting in here. It's really something. And enormous emphasis on us getting along. Enormous emphasis on maintaining the bond of peace and getting along with each other. Maybe that's why it was hard for people to raise a flag when the errors crept in, because they didn't want to be disruptive. But the overall tone is one of holiness, and that's what I get when I read the epistles and the New Testament documents. Let's go to another reference on Sabbath. This was a prayer commemorative of the incarnation of the Messiah and his various providence to the saints. O Yahweh Almighty, thou hast created the world by Messiah and hast appointed the Sabbath in memory thereof, because that on that day thou hast made us rest from our works for the meditation upon thy laws. Thou hast also appointed festivals for the rejoicing of our souls, that we might come into the remembrance of that wisdom which was created by thee. Now, this is all biblical, 100% biblical. So, yeah, you bet I crush it to my bosom. They got that right. There's another place I didn't include. There's another place where they mention festivals in the constitutions. And, of course, I look at that and I say, well, I know what festivals they're talking about, but a lot of that stuff later got hijacked. Let's see. Okay, let's talk about tithes. Tithes are in the apostolic constitutions. They are mentioned 10 times. I'm going to say about 10 times. I might have missed one. I might have double counted. Who knows? But here it has instructions about the tithe. Let him use those tithes as first fruits, which are given according to the command of Elohim, as a man of Elohim. As also let him dispense in the right manner the free will offerings which are brought in on account of the poor, to the orphans, the widows, and the afflicted, and the strangers in distress. As having that Yahweh for the examiner of his accounts, who has committed the disposition to him, distribute to all those in want with righteousness. Now, tithes are, as I observe this, tithes in these citations are typically mentioned along with offerings and first fruits. And their distinctive handling is not clear. They definitely believed in tithing. But you will find in this vast document, they seem to say slightly different things, not necessarily contradictory, but slightly different things, suggesting that there are different traditions developing among them. But it looks like the bishops and the presbyters and the deacons were very much involved with taking in tithes and making sure it went to the right people. This is one contributor to it. It's not clear who it is. It may be someone pretending to be an apostle. But they write, "I the same make a constitution in regard to first fruits and tithes, that all first fruits be brought to the bishop and to the presbyters and to the deacons for their maintenance. But let all the tithe be for the maintenance of the rest of the clergy and of the virgins and the widows." Now, the virgins and the widows, the reason you got to be careful about them is that in that society, there's no one protecting them. There's no one looking out for them. And some gals, they make a vow of virginity, or they're just going to stay virgin until they find the right guy. Who's looking out for them? Who's providing for them? And often, your local congregation played that role. So he's mentioned the rest of the clergy and of the virgins and widows and those under the trial of poverty. See if we have any tissues here. "For the first fruits belong to the priest and to those deacons that minister to them." But at least they're pulling in tithes. I don't know if I'd distribute it that way, but they did believe in tithing. So it's in the Bible. They're believing in tithing here. That means the apostles passed it on. Pentecost is simply a given in this document. Pentecost in the constitutions. Here, about halfway through the count to Pentecost, they call a meeting. "Let a synod of bishops be held twice in the year, and let them ask one another the doctrines of piety, and let them determine the ecclesiastical disputes that happen once in the fourth week of Pentecost, and again on the 12th of the month of Hyperboreteus." Now, so they're counting to Pentecost. And Pentecost is one thing the church has held on to this day. Well, there's no effort involved. It's on a Sunday. Everybody's showing up anyway, right? But during the fourth week of Pentecost, they have this get-together where all the bishops hang out. Interestingly, this is the only record I know of for this practice. And that meeting on the 12th month of Hyperboreteus, it appears to be late summer when that happens. But here's one, you might have to pay attention to follow this, but this is one I've had my periscope up a long time for this. Looking for evidence that others knew that Yahshua rose after 3 days and three nights, which means that his resurrection would be in the middle of the, quote, Passover week, the 7 days of the Days of Unleavened Bread. Somewhere in the middle would be his resurrection. If you to draw a simple diagram, you'll see 3 days and three nights gets you to a middle of the week resurrection. I don't mean the middle of the common week. I mean the Days of Unleavened week. Now, there was a later tradition that emerged. It's not documented here, but it emerged to keep a vigil on the Saturday night before Easter. This is when the Roman Church locked in this Good Friday to Sunday morning resurrection business. And so there has been a longstanding tradition of keeping vigil on a Saturday night before Easter. And that system, if you follow that system, Friday execution, then the Feast of Unleavened Bread begins, Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread begins on a Saturday, then that means your vigil would have to be early in the Passover week. It's an erroneous analysis, but I got to show you what it would be if that error was allowed to stand. Let me say it one more time for clarity. There's record of a tradition of early Christians keeping a vigil early in Passover week, specifically they wanted to replicate the events as Passover week as they understood them in Yahshua's time. So they're saying, okay, we're always going to stay up all night Saturday night. It's quite a distortion because of two things. Yahshua was resurrected late on Saturday, late on Sabbath. And the following, And the following Sunday, he was presented to the Father in his first presentation, his first ascension. And this is well understood because he wouldn't let anybody touch him early in the morning, but later on, he let people touch him. He says, I have to ascend to my Father in heaven. So even though the very first resurrection series of events was a late Saturday resurrection, early Sunday morning, he ascends to his Father for presentation like a wave sheaf. They wanted to lock in that day of the week. In this document, the Constitutions of the Apostles, they say, keep your nights of watching in the middle of the days of unleavened bread. Now, this reflects, remember, if they really think it was a Friday to Sunday thing, they'd be keeping it early in the days of unleavened bread. But this is consistent with a group of heretics called the Audians. Remember, we're students of the history of the faith, and so we're always interested in what the heretics do because they may be doing something criticized by the church, but in fact endorsed by the Bible. But the Audians, they kept a vigil in the middle of Passover week every year, a one-night vigil in the middle of the week. And the only reason you do that is to keep a watch where the 3 days and three nights would work out. And so inadvertently, this document lends weight to this idea of the resurrection and the presentation to heaven occurring after 3 days and three nights. There's a good deal of waffling in this document. Remember, it looks like other people got in there and massaged things. I'm going to quote four things, which point to the 3 days and three nights. Because when you read these documents, as I have and others, you can tell they're uncomfortable with a Friday execution and Sunday morning resurrection that doesn't quite fit. And so they try to find language to, like, get around that. Five citations. We pray thrice, standing in memory of him who arose in 3 days. Just, he arose in 3 days. They mention, now he that brought Jonah in the space of 3 days. Then they quote the master himself, the Son of Man must continue in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights. And another citation, and that he died and was buried and rose within 3 days. See how they're trying to massage the language. We have no problem saying 3 days and three nights. And another citation, on account of him who arose within the space of 3 days. So I'm giggling because I'm seeing human nature at play here. They're stuck with a liturgy. It emerged in Rome. They wanted so much to lock in everything for a Sunday resurrection. And then now they're stuck trying to explain, well, why doesn't that add up to 3 days and three nights? So they have this massage language. Arose in 3 days, in the space of 3 days, within 3 days, as though 3 days was kind of an upper limit. That was 3 days and three nights. Maybe someday one of us will pull in everything we can on this 3 days and three nights. It is absolutely breathtaking. You know, there's actually a sector of scholarship out there among real serious scholars for whom it's common knowledge the Last Supper was a Tuesday night. But how you get there takes some doing. We've known this for as long as I've been in the movement. Now, Passover is vigorously acknowledged in the Apostolic Constitutions, but they put an emphasis on the equinox over the biblical focus on barley. Now, the Bible synchronizes everything to that barley harvest. And our objective is to have quality barley for the wave sheaf offering. If you do it too soon, it's mush. If you do it too late, it's decomposed. We put an emphasis on that barley sighting, and that's why we get these reports from the middle, from the Holy Land. This document appears to come originally from the Levant, people like in Syria. It appears to be anyway from other evidences. Notice that they mention the Passover here many times in this document. But two of the citation, it is therefore your duty, brethren, who are redeemed by the precious blood of Messiah, to observe the days of the Passover exactly with all care after the vernal equinox, lest ye be obliged to keep the memorial of the one passion twice a year. In fact, they're so wound up over this, they say if any bishop or presbyter or deacon shall celebrate the holiday of the Passover before the vernal equinox with the Jews, let him be deprived. So on one hand, you got to keep Passover and the whole week. They keep the whole week. This is very evident, but they just make sure it happens after equinox. So I've been trying to figure out, well, why would they say that? Because the Bible clearly has an emphasis on the barley. And furthermore, they warn you, don't keep it like the Jews do it. But don't want to do it what the Jews do. And I'm convinced the reason they put the emphasis on that is because the equinox was important in parts of the world where this originated, like Syria. We're almost done. I hope the moderator is ready. It looks like we do have a short one today. Oh, there you are. Let me give you a summary of this. I wouldn't recommend anybody become an expert on this book, but it is good to know that there are many things we believe, teach, and uphold which are reflected here as the Roman church started sliding toward, grand error. In summary, reading the checkered content of the constitutions will cause one to halt, celebrate, etc. The safe approach is to use these information filters that I've developed. If there is an entry supported by the Bible, yet later abandoned by Christianity at large, if the answer is yes, then we have documentation for our practices preserved by hostile witnesses. Second, is there an entry showing a distortion of biblical practice, but still getting close? I'll say yes, but we have a snapshot then of liturgical decay. And is there content foreign to the Bible? Well, there's no surprise there. That's just going to happen. I'm going to close with a little anecdote. Forgive me for twice told tales if you've heard this before. But in Chicago, in the Chicago area, there was three branches of the Church of God Seventh Day, and two of them were Hispanic. And I had friends who knew those people in the Hispanic realm. And then a bizarre thing happened. The leadership started calling for Bible studies about Sabbath. We got to study this thing. We got to look into this thing. And one thing we've observed over the years, if you don't remind a congregation periodically why you're keeping Sabbath, if you don't make that clear, they start to drift. This fellowship that I have in mind, they had over a period of several months these studies about Saturday and Sunday and what's going on. Then they took a vote and they voted for Sunday. So in less than a generation, in less than a year, the Sabbatarian congregation pivoted to Sunday. And you wonder why? Here we have verification that Seventh-day Sabbath continued deep into the Roman era. But it does show, a real live modern example like that shows how quickly things can change if you don't hold on. I wouldn't recommend you try to be an expert on this, but I want you to know that we're people preserving much of our beliefs even in the face of a lot of temptation to compromise. I really appreciate your kind attention. I welcome questions, and if anybody wants the materials I've unearthed, you can just ask for them. Mighty Shalom, brethren.